from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. The crisis in Haiti created innumerable compelling stories, among them the question of international adoption, both its promise and its peril. There were adoption efforts that seemed heroic, others that seemed misguided at best. In our next hour forum, we take a look at international adoption. It's actually getting tougher to adopt children from other countries. The numbers have declined by almost half in the past 6 years. We'll examine why that decline has taken place when there's seemingly so many children in need, and we'll explore what prospective adoptive parents need to consider if they want to pursue adopting children from abroad. International adoption, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. 6 years ago, nearly 23,000 children from abroad were adopted by parents in the United States, far more than were adopted by people in any other country. But by last year, that number had fallen almost in half to 12,700, and the expectation is that fewer than 10,000 international adoptions will take place in the U.S. this year. Why is that number dropping so dramatically, especially when humanitarian crises around the world seem to point to so many children in need? It's not for lack of desire, but issues ranging from concern over child trafficking to changes in adoption attitudes in other countries. All of those things have affected the prospects for international adoption. And yet, there are an estimated 153 million orphans worldwide. Should more be done to facilitate international adoption, or are there better ways to help the world's neediest children? And for prospective adoptive parents, what should they think about before pursuing this particular path? We're going to focus on international adoption during this hour of Forum. Joining us to do that, Tom DiFilippo. He's president and CEO of the Joint Council on International Children's Services, a child advocacy group that focuses on international adoptions. Tom DiFilippo, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having us, Dave.
Janet Shirley joins us as well, overseas program coordinator for Bay Area Adoption Services and the mother of an adopted son from Honduras. Janet Shirley, good morning.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Marguerite Wright joins us as well. She is a senior clinical and research psychologist at the Center for the Vulnerable Child at Oakland Children's Hospital and Research Center, also the author of I'm Chocolate, You're Vanilla, Raising Healthy Black and Biracial Children in a Race-Conscious World. Dr. Wright, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us as well, E.J. Graff, Associate Director and Senior Researcher for the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. He's been reporting on international adoption for a variety of publications, including Foreign Policy Magazine and The Washington Post. E.J. Graff, thanks for being with us, too.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also going to hear from other adoptive parents throughout the course of the hour, but I want to begin by getting your sense of this sort of bigger question, I guess, over whether or not this is the right thing to do. We just spent an hour, our last hour of Forum, talking about the ongoing crisis in Haiti, where there are so many children in need. And there are children in need, of course, all over the globe. And yet there is this push and pull between whether or not adopting kids is the right thing to do and whether or not we should invest resources in that country so that children can remain there. As you've thought about this issue, worked on this issue, experienced this issue as an adoptive parent, Janet Shirley, what's your view on that?
Well, Dave, I think to answer your question, there's room for both. There's room. We definitely need to have humanitarian aid in many countries. Haiti typifies the kind of situation where humanitarian aid is absolutely necessary. And it's humanitarian aid is not the solution to worldwide poverty. Is there room for international adoption? Absolutely yes. Definitively yes. And I think for many years to come, there's room for international adoption to address some of the issues of global poverty and the fact that there's many orphans around the world. It is not the total solution to a global problem we're looking at, where indeed over half the world lives in poverty. I think it's over 70% of humanity lives on less than a dollar a day. And as you mentioned, there's over 153 million orphans worldwide. I also do work in Uganda, and my spare time is a volunteer. And alone in Uganda, there's 2.5 million orphans who have no place to go.
Tamti Philippa, where do you come down on this continuum of approaches and need, the need to adopt versus, in a sense, when you it seems impressive that a few years ago more than 20,000 children were adopted in this country, and yet it's such a small percentage of children in need. So can it really be a real solution to the world's neediest kids?
Well, I think Janet's right on the money with her description and her position on this, but is it going to be the solution? No. Should it be a part of the broader solution? Absolutely. There's never one solution to any problem, whether it's poverty, child abuse, child trafficking. Certainly children that living outside of permanent parental care can benefit from inter-country adoption, but there must be more focus on family preservation work so that children are not orphaned or abandoned or relinquished in the first place. There needs to be more economic development efforts in many of these countries. Those type of efforts to keep kids in their families of birth, I think, needs to be the number one priority. But that's not the reality yet. We're not there yet. So until we're there, I think international adoption plays a role, just not the only role.
E.J. Griffiths, you've written about this issue. You've focus some concern on the question of countries where there have been issues of child trafficking and corruption. That's been a particular issue in both in Guatemala and Vietnam, countries that in the past sent a fair number of children to this country for adoption. How do you view this particular question as to whether or not international adoption is the best way to approach the needs of the world's neediest children?
Well, at the risk of too much unanimity, I certainly both Janet and Tom are correct. Part of, not the largest part of, helping children in need. But what I wanted to point out is that number 163 million orphans is a very problematic number, and I think it misleads a lot of prospective adoptive parents. That number comes from the UNAIDS project. And those 163 million are children who have lost at least one parent. 95% of them have lost one parent, not necessarily to AIDS. And of the 5% who have lost both parents, they are not necessarily without a family. They may be living with extended family. They may be living in a child welfare institution of some kind that we might call an orphanage, but would locally be considered more like a boarding school for parole children. That's almost certainly not an optimal way to raise a child. I'm not saying that's a good thing. But even of those 5%, very few of them are available for international adoption. The ones who are probably 5 or older and have lived through some kind of trauma, whether it's the death of parents or a civil war or some other witnessing of trauma and abuse. So they're not necessarily the children that most Westerners, and the U.S. is only responsible for 50% of adoptions worldwide, more or less, most Westerners are not necessarily prepared to take in a special needs child, which is what these children are. I'm not saying no one is. When people think about adoption, they are often thinking about infant and toddler adoption.
Well, let's pursue that, because that brings us, Dr. Marguerite Wright, to this question of what parents, prospective adoptive parents, really ought to think about. Because as E.J. Graff suggests, as I've read at least about this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, many of the kids who can be adopted are kids with children with special need. I've read that, for example, 60% of the children from China who can be adopted are children with special needs and are older, not the infant that might be the ideal dream for a prospective parent. So what should prospective parents really think about before going down this particular path?
Prospective parents really should understand what they want and what they're getting themselves into. Aside from being older children and children of special needs, these are usually children of color. And I think going back to the initial question, which relates to this, one has to really approach this from multiple fronts. Not only preserving the family, but preserving the culture. But I really take it from a child's perspective, and that is these children are in desperate needs, and their families are confronted with violence, deprivation, and so forth. So anything that someone could do to alleviate this suffering does contribute to the solution. So again, it's really important that we approach it from different angles.
But it sounds like you're also saying, well, the love that a prospective parent can give that child in need is hugely important. It in and of itself is not enough, that if you're going to adopt a child from another culture, particularly if it's from another race, that has to be a huge part of this equation too.
Essentially, it's fundamentally, it has to be part of the solution. And what we're finding with a number of adoption agencies now is they're encouraging parents to immerse themselves in the culture, to really get to know this child, to have transitional time where they can really come to know the child, to understand the child's culture before they make the transition to our country.
And what has that meant in concrete terms for you, Janet Shirley, as the mother of a child, a boy that you adopted from Honduras? What does that mean actually? It must mean more than simply going to Honduras on a trip. I mean, what does that actually involve?
Well, absolutely. And yes, we adopted our son. He was born in 1987 and came into our family in 88. He's from Tegucigalpa. And we thought long and hard about international adoption before we decided to go forward. I have lived extensively in Central America, have a lot of friends who are Latinos, and I knew that that would be something very important to reinforce when we went ahead to adopt our son. Our organization, Bay Area Adoption Services, has been around since 1984. We're a nonprofit serving the entire Bay Area, and we have mandatory pre-adopt classes in which we, which are mandatory. The parents must go through an educational process in which we talk openly about preserving culture, you know, the implications of race when they're adopting transracially, because the majority of adoptions we do are transracial placements. And so we've had over 2,000 children. We've helped over 2,000 children find homes in the Bay Area since 1984, and most of those adoptions have been transracial. But it's so important. I think Marguerite is totally correct. We must prepare the parents for the cultural and racial implications of being a transracial family from the very beginning. And I believe we're doing a fairly good job with that.
Tom DiFilippo, on this question of preparing parents, there was the now infamous story of Terri Ann Hansen, the woman from Tennessee who sent her child back home, a 7-year-old, back to Russia because the child wasn't the child she'd hoped for. Seems like an incident where a parent was clearly not ready for what she happened to be going through. Are we focused enough on this issue? Are prospective parents tuned in enough to what they're really getting into?
Well, if by enough you mean that 100% of adoptive parents will be perfectly situated and educated, then no, you'll never get to 100%. And that specific case did not really point to systemic problems with the inter-country adoption process. It did point to a problem with the decision-making of a specific parent. Now, that's not to say that we don't need more education and training. That's certainly, we can never have enough preparation, whether it's cultural or specific to a child's special needs. But I'd like to jump back to one quick point because I think that it's important to bring some clarity to some of the comments already made today. The 153 million orphans that we've referenced and that you see in publications all the time, that issue isn't only problematic. That has no relevance to what we're talking about today. Those 153 million is a number derived for bringing concern and programs to children orphaned as a result of AIDS. Just because EJ referenced 95% of those children have living parents, 100% of the children in the U.S. foster system have living parents. yet many of them need adoptive families. So that whether a parent is living or not is really not the question. It's whether or not the child is in need of a permanent family, whether it's through kinship care or permanent foster care, permanent guardianship, or adoption in country or out of country. That's the question. So that number is really problematic and shouldn't even be part of the discussion, in our opinion.
Tom DeFilippo joining us this hour from the Joint Council on International Children's Services, a child advocacy group that focuses on international adoptions. I understand that numbers are problematic, and this is a very difficult number to get your arms around. But I guess where I want to go next with this, E.J. Graff, is we do see this huge number of kids in need, whether they are kids of special needs, whether they're older or not. And you have parents eager in this country to meet that need. I know you also have some concerns, though, about that parental eagerness sometimes taking people in directions they ought not follow, that it is possible to go find an infant in some country if you hire a lawyer and go do that. Tell me something about your concerns about those particular issues, that whether it's in a place like Haiti, where it is possible to do that, or elsewhere, that people are going to pursue what they should not pursue.
I want to say I would never blame the adoptive parents for wanting to have a child. I think that's a fabulous human impulse, to want to give love in a family to a child who needs one. Where the issue lies is with some adoption agencies in the West that are pouring disproportionate amounts of money into poor and at times unregulated countries that can be misused by unscrupulous middle people. I don't want to see just middlemen on the ground in those countries to buy or defraud or abduct a child at times away from a family that wanted to try and raise it to adulthood. No one can tell you how often that happens, but there are countries in which corrupt systems take root and are very hard to, once that happens, it's very hard to know if any individual adoption is really a necessary adoption in those countries. And if anyone is making a decision right now about what country to adopt from, my recommendation would be to go with a Hague signatory country. That's a little technical. So there's an international treaty called the Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption, and countries that have signed onto it are more likely to have controls in place to help them prevent a child from going to the United States who has really been bought for is sold into international adoption.
I want to come back to the question of the Hague Conventions, because this in itself, as I understand it, is controversial within adoption circles. But before we do that, Dr. Marguerite Wright, can you add anything to what's been said about how prospective parents begin this process, given that there are some unscrupulous activities out there, and there are no longer at the moment. We've pretty much shut down adoptions from Guatemala and Vietnam in particular. How can prospective parents most be aware of where they ought to proceed? Do you have any suggestions on how to find the best agency to go through or how to go forward in this arena?
I think an agency like Janet's is has excellent reputation, really a sterling reputation. One would go there. There's the Adoption Nation. You know, at the end of this, we could give out some websites, some refer to some books. So I think there are many reputable agencies now that are available to parents who are interested in pursuing adoption. But I also want to make the point. I remember just recently seeing a picture of orphans who are taking care of other orphans, children taking care of orphans in Haiti on the front page of the New York Times. And that was heart-rending. So although I really see the need, desperate need for regulations right now of international adoption. I think what whichever way we could get those children, we could alleviate their suffering, we really should pursue it.
Let me read something from that article that you referenced. Marguerite Wright was referring to an article that appeared in the New York Times the other day about the situation with orphans in Haiti, and it describes the scene at one orphanage in particular. Here are a couple of excerpts from that article. 13-year-old Michelle Point du Jour, who lost both parents in the earthquake, cooks and feeds for the younger children. She prepares rice and beans, and while many of the children appear healthier now than a few months ago, most, if not all, are malnourished and have chronic intestinal parasitic infections. On a recent Sunday, the newest arrivals, 11-month-old twin girls named Magda and Magdalene Charles, lay limp and intertwined on a urine-soaked rug under a mango tree. They were covered with flies. They arrived naked and dehydrated, Pastor Gerald Batale said, who supervises the orphanage. Their mother said, "If you leave them with me, they're going to die. So although we're not equipped for babies, we took them." It's a story, Tom DiFilippo, that moves you, as Dr. Marguerite Wright suggests, and the question is, how should one be moved? What is the best way to proceed? E.J. Graff mentioned respecting the Hague Conventions, which set up certain regulations for how adoption should take place. The concern that's sometimes raised is that if you only go with countries that have adopted those conventions, then you leave that many more children in situations and conditions like the ones I just described.
Right, and I agree in part with EJ in that if you can go to a country that has just fully implemented The Hague, that would be a good way to go. However, and Joint Council, of which I'm president, obviously, we fully support The Hague. I'm on the board of directors for an organization that accredits agencies here in the U.S., so we completely support it. However, as you said, Dave, not every country is a Hague country, and even some of those that are, you still need to be concerned about corruption. So there's countries in Central America, South America, in Africa, for instance, Kenya is a Hague country. I'd be less or more concerned about an adoption from Kenya than I would from Russia, which is not a Hague country. Ethiopia is not a Hague country, and neither is Haiti. So to limit it to just Hague countries, I think, would be a mistake. And what I think at the core here is on the issue of corruption. It's the response to it that brings concern and can further victimize children. So in Guatemala, certainly that system needed to be reformed. It had become commercialized. Adoption fees into the country were approaching $80 million a year for only assisting 4,000 or 5,000 children. But the response of closing that and eliminating children's rights to a family through international adoption is abusive, and we're seeing it in Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, in Vietnam, Cambodia, Romania. I could go on. So why the response is to close it, I think, points to a predisposition of some in the larger community to see international adoption as a service that should not be available to children. And we just completely disagree with that.
Tom DiFilippo at the Joint Council on International Children's Services. We have to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to talk more about the experience of being an international adoption family, what that process is like, what it takes to go through, how long the wait can be, what it costs, what the joys are, what the challenges are. We'll get into all of that when we return. We want to hear from you as well. If you are a prospective adoptive parent, or if you already are, we'd like to hear your story too. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. International adoption is our topic this hour. Our guests include Dr. Marguerite Wright, who is a clinical and research psychologist at the Center for the Vulnerable Child at the Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland. E.J. Graff, investigative journalist who's written about this issue in the Washington Post and other publications. Janet Shirley, overseas program coordinator for Bay Area Adoption Services and an adoptive parent. And Tom DiFilippo, president and CEO of the Joint Council on International Children's Services. We welcome your calls and questions, too, particularly if this is an issue that you've dealt with in your own life. We'd like to hear your story. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and just click on this segment and you can add your comment online. We're joined also as well now by Kathleen Nielsen. She recently adopted a child from China, and she is also on the Bay Area Adoption Services Board. Kathleen Nielsen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You adopted a child from China, and we were talking earlier about some of the issues involved in both cross-cultural and cross-racial adoption. Walk us through your own experience with that, what you are doing with your child to try to sustain that cultural connection.
Well, with respect to the cultural connection, I'm very fortunate to live in the Bay Area. And so the Bay Area is pretty rich in cultural diversity, especially with the Asian community. And then there are also available to adoptive parents various organizations such as Families with Children from China, who organize a lot of events around the major Chinese holidays, such as Lunar New Year, Moon Festival, things like that, that help us keep our children in touch with the culture that they came from. I myself am also, my significant other is from Hong Kong, and he speaks many different dialects and helps her also stay connected to that, the culture from which she comes. So I think we are lucky enough here to stay very connected.
Yeah. And how old is your daughter?
She is now 7 years old.
And you adopted her at what age?
At 2.5.
And what's been the most challenging aspect of this experience for you?
Well, I think for any parent, becoming a parent is challenging in and of itself. Each child is different. They have their own personalities, and you kind of have to learn how to deal with that and compare that to your own preconceived notions about what parenting is about. And then any of us who have adopted children, they have an early life trauma that we don't really understand. Mm. And that manifests itself in different ways, some very severe, some not so severe. My daughter in particular is very shy. And so getting her to express her feelings, get through those kinds of things, and also dealing with having a family structure that's different than others. Not only does her mom not look like her, but mom is actually a single parent. And so there's a lot of different aspects of her family life that may be different than her friends. Mm. And so I think those are the biggest issues, and just trying to come to grips not only ourselves, but also helping our children come to grips with the early life trauma that they've had is a challenge for any parent.
And what's been the most joyful?
Oh, gosh. Being a mom, having her there every day. She's hysterical. She's this funny little amazing person that I just couldn't imagine life without.
Kathleen Nielsen, thanks for sharing your story with us this morning. We appreciate your participation in our program.
Thanks for having me.
Marguerite Wright, Kathleen Nielsen mentioned this interesting challenge of a family structure not being necessarily what her child would have known in China. We think of cultural connection in terms of language, race, various questions like that. I don't know as I necessarily would have thought of things like family structures being different. There's a pretty wide array, I guess, of things that prospective adoptive parents and international adoptions really need to be tuned into.
Indeed. But first, I must say I'm very impressed hearing from Kathleen, especially when you ask her the question about her joys. You almost felt she was beaming through the microphone. So, yes, indeed, it's a very complex culture and race. And the fact that now there's a real encouragement among adoption agencies of parents to maintain these connection is very important. particularly children of color come into our country where race historically is such an emotionally charged issue. But there's something I want to add, and Kathleen mentioned this when you talk to her, when you ask her the questions about the challenges. And she not only mentioned race and culture, she talked about her child's personality. One has to be really careful here. There are certain individuals, understandably, for hurts and pains that they may have experienced over the years, push a ideological or political agenda where they focus on race and culture and want to limit international adoption because of those issues. But we are multifaceted beings, and we are more than our race and culture. So one has to be very careful not to be drawn into that.
Are you suggesting that we shouldn't necessarily make an assumption that because a child is experiencing a particular problem or exhibiting a particular behavior, that that's tied to race and culture?
Exactly. Again, one has to be really sensitive and mindful and maintain those connection and attend to those issues. But one could go, and it's really a delicate balance, one could go to the other extreme and become so obsessed with race and culture that's all the child is.
Yeah. Dr. Marguerite Wright joining us. She's a clinical and research psychologist at the Center for the Vulnerable Child in Oakland. Also the author of I'm Chocolate, You're Vanilla, Raising Healthy Black and Biracial Children in a Race-Conscious World. Let's hear from some of our listeners this morning about their own experiences, concerns, questions about the topic of international adoption. Sarah joins us first from Asheville, North Carolina. Sarah, go ahead, please.
Hi, I was calling in. My husband and I are going through the process of trying to start the international adoption in Haiti specifically. And we have ran into, obviously, all the problems that everyone has heard. And the biggest thing that we know, and if, especially after hearing all the people that have talked this morning, that we know is important is just keeping her community and not letting her forget her heritage and her language. The little girl that we are trying to adopt, obviously there's lots of problems and stuff that are going on over there, but the biggest thing that we know is that she needs a family and she needs someone that cares for her and is willing to fight for her. So that's the thing that we've been dealing mostly with is just the fight that comes with the whole process. And I don't know if that makes any sense. My words aren't very together because
no, I understand. No, Sarah, thanks. Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for calling and participating. And Janet Shirley, maybe you can respond because it is a long process. It's an arduous undertaking, and it sounds like Sarah is in the middle of it.
Yeah. Sarah, I really applaud your sentiment. I mean, it was the same kind of sentiments I had when I was adopting my son from Honduras a number of years ago. It is a lengthy process. International adoption is a lengthy process for a number of reasons. The first 6 months, the adoptive parents have to go through a home study process. They're interviewed by a social worker. They have to go through four different types of police checks, federal fingerprinting, fingerprinting with the Department of Justice, the Child Abuse Index clearance. They have to get permission to adopt from our own U.S. Immigration Services. And only after that are they considered now eligible to be able to adopt and to get on a waiting list for adoption. In Sarah's case in particular, it's, you know, when a country has just been experiencing strife of some kind, whether it's civil war or some kind of environmental disaster, more often than not, adoptions are going to be very hard to do following that particular disaster. And I think Haiti is a case in point, and I think Tom DiFilippo can talk more about this because he's made several trips to Haiti since the earthquake. But the infrastructure's gone. Many things are not in place in order to assist international adoption to continue. And so Sarah's going to be looking at a number of challenges because Haiti is trying to get back on its feet. So what that implies is that she may be waiting for long periods of time before adoptions are are able to continue. And I think Tom could talk more about this situation.
We have lots of callers who want to get in and add their questions and perspectives. Mm-hmm. So, Tom DiFilippo, just a brief additional thought, if you have one, about where Sarah and others can turn to. Because in some ways, it's important for it to take time in Haiti, because you have all the concerns about making sure that there is the opportunity for reuniting with a parent, too. So for someone like Sarah, for someone who's pursuing Haiti adoption in particular, are there places you can go to get good advice?
Certainly. Well, you could give us a call, send us an email, go to our website. We're intimately involved with Haiti and have been for 10 years, but most definitely after the earthquake. And what we would say to Sarah and many others who are in the adoption process in Haiti is to stay committed to the child that you are hoping to adopt, because it is going to take time before. Here's a perfect example. The social service ministry is working out of tents, literally, right now. We just came back from Haiti 2 weeks ago, and their capacity to process intercountry adoptions or any social services in Haiti is minimal at best. It's still an ongoing crisis and still a disaster there. And today, as a matter of fact, is the 12-month remembrance of the six-month remembrance.
Yeah.
Thank you, of the Haiti earthquake.
Yeah. Let's go to Rosa next, who has an observation to make. Rosa, go ahead, please.
Yes. I'm from San Francisco, and I was adopted from Honduras in 1985. And I grew up in a transracial household, and I just had an amazing experience growing up and just have so many opportunities. I went to a four-year college. I'm working in San Francisco right now. I don't know what I would have done if I was not adopted by my adopted family right now. And it was just amazing. I've been able to travel all over the world, which I never would have been able to do, and just a loving household.
And Rosa, do you still feel a real connection to the Honduran part of who you are? And how were your parents, if so, how were your parents able to sustain that?
Well, I did travel back to Honduras twice since I've grown up, when I was 15 and 13. And it's also growing up in the Bay Area, I just feel connected to many cultures, so not just my own, but I think that was unique growing up in San Francisco. So I feel connected to many, and I grew up in an Irish-Italian household, so I also feel that, too. It's a very unique experience.
Rosa, thanks. Thanks for your observation and for sharing your experience with us this morning. Liz joins us next in Mountain View. Liz, you're on.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Yes, I am an adoptive parent. I have a 10-year-old girl who was 5 months old when I brought her home from Guatemala. And I went through Bay Area Adoption Services, and I think Janet actually maybe was the one who called me to tell me that there was a child for me.
Yes, I think that's true.
My name's Liz Miller, and it was just an absolutely joyous, wonderful experience from top to bottom. There were some frustrations. There's lots of paperwork involved, and there was waiting when I didn't want to have to wait anymore, but in general, things went the way they were supposed to go.
Liz, thank you. We're losing you a bit on your cell phone connection, but we've got the heart of your story, very much the heart of it, and thank you for sharing it with us. Liz just mentioned, and maybe E.J. Graff or Tom DiFilippo, you can respond to this, the question of weight and cost, and we're getting a number of other emails and questions about that. Here's one from Anuja, who writes, for years I tried to become a mother and could not. Finally, I decided to adopt, but the cost and time was so overwhelming that I backed off. Why is adoption so expensive? $20,000 to $25,000 per child. That seems insane for someone who wants to adopt but does not have that kind of money. And as I understand it, Tom DiFilippo, the cost can be far greater than that.
Oh, yes, certainly, Dave. The cost can escalate up to $40,000 to $50,000, depending on the country that you're adopting from, such as Russia, because of the 2 to 3 trips and the amount of time that you need to stay in country. For instance, in Kazakhstan, you're required to stay 6 weeks. So those kind of travel costs certainly escalate the total cost of the adoption. What families need to be careful of, in our opinion, in addition to trying to just deal with the struggle of raising that kind of money, is why is the adoption expensive for a particular country, and is the agency you're using, is their fees in line with everyone else? So Russia, we know a lot of the cost is travel. In Guatemala a few years ago, most of the cost was going to attorneys. So there's a complete differential there, and it goes back to what EJ said.
Yeah.
Where's that money going? So if it's a legitimate reason and your agency's in line with everyone, great. But if there's some red flags, you know, back up and investigate a little bit more and do your due diligence.
So, EJ Graf, do you have to be a bit of the investigative reporter as you're pursuing this, that you really do need to follow the money, you really do need to ask questions? And if someone says, we can do an adoption for $10,000 and it's a healthy infant, rather than that being a good sign, it might not be that at all.
Well, if you can find a place that to get a healthy infant for $10,000, you will have many people knocking on your door. I haven't heard of that. I could be wrong. Tom could tell me I'm wrong, but I haven't heard that cost. I would more be concerned about agencies that say they can get you a healthy infant quickly. The wait is heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking, especially when one knows all the things people have been talking about, that there is a child suffering somewhere with parasites and so on. We would be inhuman if that didn't seem horrifying. But the wait is important because that gives an opportunity for people in countries where it's being done well to investigate and check to see whether their family can be brought back together, which would be better for the child in some cases, if it's not an abusive or alcoholic home. And for people to check on us. I know that's heartbreaking, too, to think, well, if I could just have gotten pregnant, then no one would be running a Corey on me. That's what we call it here in Massachusetts, a criminal check. But you certainly don't want a child from Russia or Haiti or wherever to go to a family that's really going to use it for a bad purpose.
So it sounds like, Janet Shirley, as frustrating as the wait and the cost can be, that there are reasons for that. And what prospective parents have to understand is the why behind that.
Yeah.
And to ask good questions about the cost, as Tom DeFilippo is suggesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. Whether we like it or not, many, many parents that decide to adopt and then adopt internationally, they've already been faced with challenges of fertility. They've been waiting long periods of time to start a family. And so
They feel like the clock's ticking already.
They feel like the clock's ticking. And that was certainly my case as well. But there are some very necessary checks that parents have to go through. And like I mentioned, the fingerprinting, the police clearance. They have to get federal clearance so that they can get immigration permission to bring a child into this country. But on the other side, too, the foreign country also wants to check us out to make sure that the parents coming to them to receive their children will be good parents. And so it's on both sides.
And to Anne.
Can I add one more thing?
Just briefly, please. I've got another caller on the line. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, I understand. And I don't think it should be the parents' responsibility to check constantly on where all the money is going. That's where we have a government. And right now, the federal government does not have what many people would consider adequate checks on where that money is going. And there are there's some legislative efforts going forward to try and increase the regulation so that it's a little more effective in screening out corruption. But do not go with an agency that asks you to carry cash into a poor country.
EJ Graf, joining us from the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. Let's go to Anne next in San Francisco. Anne, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to give a little bit different perspective than people have been giving. I have a daughter from Russia, and I adopted her at 1 year. And we've had a lot of problems. First of all, I don't regret doing it. I would do it in a heartbeat, and she's going to be a wonderful child in her life when she's an adult. But the problem is that she's got health issues, she's got developmental issues, special needs, and getting support from the school district now that she's school age has been a nightmare. And I don't think I'm just speaking for adopted children. I'm speaking for all children of parents, you know, parents with kids with special needs. But, you know, it's a wonderful thing to do. I went through the fertility thing, and I could have gone the egg donor route, but I adopted a child, and I encourage everybody to do it. But I just want people to know that, you know, these kids come with some baggage. Mm-hmm. And my daughter had some traumatic experiences as an infant, and they've impacted her now. And she has so many wonderful strengths. But just navigating, you know, through the just the normal life of a child, you know, having her in group situations with other kids in the school district, they're wanting to put her in special classes. I mean, it's just been very difficult. And I felt that in the community, there's just not that much support. Luckily, I have the financial means to, you know, work with a lot of specialists and people like that. But, you know, it's a difficult road.
Yeah. And, you know. And thank you. Thanks for adding that. It's a really important point, Dr. Marguerite Wright, about all the resources, not only that you have to put forward in adopting a child, but the number of resources that you need after the child is yours. And as Anne suggests, that's a particularly difficult question, perhaps right now in California, because of the situation that so many of our schools face. So there really are a lot of things that you have to be thinking about as you approach this.
Indeed, and my heart goes out to Anne and her family, and it looks like she's rallied with her child. But this is where there's a real need for regulation and transparency, that she really knows this child, and the agency, the adopting agency, discloses the child's background.
But can you know? Can a prospective parent really know?
No,
could Anne really know who's going to arrive?
Bird parents can't know.
Yeah,
bird
parents
can't know who's born to us. But here there's even another layer. But I was going back to the previous conversation, which relates to this. In this age of advanced technology, there are a lot of other resources available to us to really be able to expedite this process of knowing. And I think we're using an old model in a modern time to get to go through this adoptive process. And we really need to think outside the box and find other ways. There are a lot of brilliant people in this field where they can really advance a process where we can have more knowing as much as one can. But as I said, being a birth parent myself, you don't really know until the child is born to you and as the child lives unfold. Of course, with adoptive parents from other countries, there are even other multiple layers.
And to John in Oakland next. John, go ahead.
Hi, my name is John Launder. And I'm kind of like the modern family. I don't know if you've seen the show, but my husband and I adopted a son. And we had to do it domestic because internationally we had to lie on the home study if we were going to go that route. And I'm just curious if that's changing in a lot of countries. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
John, thanks. On the question of gay adoption, Tom DiFilippo, what are some of the regulations and requirements? I'm sure that must vary country to country.
It's relatively uniform, actually, Dave. The availability of gay couples to adopt overseas is almost nil, with the exception of South Africa. I'm not aware of any country that would allow a placement of a child with a gay family. And South Africa does not conduct international adoption with the United States. So there's really no options. And I just want to throw two quick points. No one should ever be asked to nor participate in lying about their sexual orientation or anything about their life in order to complete an adoption. If it just goes, we don't want corruption in the other countries. We don't want corruption here. And this earlier conversations about the length that it takes for adoption, let's keep in mind that while we're waiting here as adoptive parents, the children are waiting there.
Yeah.
And the damage, it's hard for us. Absolutely. It's traumatic. It's everything. But let's keep the child's perspective in mind. And when Dr. Wright said that we can find ways to do this faster, we absolutely can.
Well, what would
it's
be
just
some
a matter
of those
of committing resources?
Yeah, what would be some of those ways? I mean, some of the articles I read indicated that for every month the child is in an institution, that there's a developmental price for that. And so those are the real costs and concerns and time that you're talking about, Tom DiFilippo. So what could expedite that?
Well, a registration system is key, regardless of what country you're adopting. And in Russia, once you receive the referral of a child, the process goes relatively quick because they've already investigated the child. The child has a birth history. There's some medical information, whether it's accurate or not, is often in question, but they have a really good registry system. In countries like Haiti or in Guatemala, where there's no registry, we don't have a documented way of saying, yes, this child was abandoned on this date, having faith that it was a legitimate abandonment. So the process, all that investigation starts much too late in the process.
Yeah.
So a good registry system would help a lot.
Let's hear from one more caller. We're almost out of time. But Chris in Davis, you're on with us. Just a quick observation, if you would, please.
Yes, my name is Chris, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I have two children adopted from the Philippines. One was adopted before the Hague Convention was in place. It took 2 years to do, and then the other was a three-year process after the Hague. And it took a long time, and it was frustrating along the way, but the payoff was tremendous. And I think it's important for parents to know why they're adopting, not to think that it's their attempt to save the world or not because they think it's easy, obviously, but because they want to do it. And I just think that it's important to put that out there. And if I may say one more thing in following the woman from Honduras, she said she had a great experience, and kids can. It's also important to continue to celebrate the culture from which kids come through heritage camps, which operates out of Colorado, or any way to celebrate the culture from which the child comes is great to do.
Chris, thanks. Thanks for joining us and adding your experience to our collective experience this morning. Janet Shirley, a last quick thought as an adoptive parent on what you'd like people to consider and where they might go if they want to consider this further.
Well, I'd really like to echo what the last caller said. International adoption is a wonderful way to build a family. It's not an easy experience, but it is so rewarding. And I would just like to encourage our listeners out there, if any of you are thinking about building your family, that you consider international adoption as a way to build your family. And that's it.
Janet Shirley, she joins us this morning as the Overseas Program Coordinator for Bay Area Adoption Services. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Marguerite Wright joined us as well. She's a clinical and research psychologist at the Center for the Vulnerable Child at the Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland. Dr. Wright, thank you.
My pleasure.
We were also heard earlier from Kathleen Nielsen, an adoptive parent. Tom DiFilippo is the president and CEO of the Joint Council on International Children's Services. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And E.J. Graff, the associate director and senior researcher at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. E.J., thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.